welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. We are back. Gone for a few weeks. I was off in Australia. I was in South Africa. I have returned back to the United States, and I've returned to my very podcast here, the Bill Barnwell Show. So thanks so much for tolerating a few weeks off. I was on vacation, really enjoyed myself. But we're back to the business of sports. I would say sports because later on we're going to have Ben Lindbergh, my former Grantland colleague, who now works for The Ringer, talking about his new book, The MVP Machine, which is excellent. We'll get to more of that after the break. But first, wanted to have our guest today on to talk about his pet peeve, it's fair to say. He is someone who is very passionate about a very, very distinct element of the NFL, something that's come up a little bit, actually, this Monday afternoon as we record. But here to make the argument against replay existing is our friend Dan Graziano. Dan, how are you?
I'm good, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. I have been meaning to do this with you for a while because you are someone who are generally very mild-mannered. I would say the one exception, I would say, on Twitter is that when replays take over an NFL game, I would say you enter into a rage. Is that fair?
I also wouldn't confine it to NFL. I mean, I don't like watching them in baseball. I don't like watching them in basketball. I just think it's not good television. So, yeah, my position is a minority position, and I recognize this. But I feel like, you know, when you're in a minority position these days, you have to yell extra loud in order for anybody to even hear it. Mm-hmm. So, my position is that all replay review in all sports should be immediately abolished because it's terrible and detracts from the enjoyment of the game, which I look at and say the league should be paying more attention to, right? The enjoyment of their game. What is their game like to watch? Because I think ultimately that is a more potentially harmful place to fail than, you know, bad calls. I think the pursuit of perfection on officiating could have detrimental consequences long term to sports.
Okay, so let's start with this. So if I asked you why you hate replays, your answer seems to be because it's aesthetically unappealing and it makes for a bad television product. Is that fair?
Right, and the proliferation of it and the expansion of it is making games more difficult to watch. So if it's, I remember I was covering baseball when they put it in, and it was supposed to be boundary calls, right? Calls like fair or foul on home runs, like where the umpire is too far away to see. And it's fine, because that's a call that they can't make. But to keep adding what they've added, and now you get to a point where like the shortstop is holding the ball and his glove on the runner's foot at second base in case he slid off by a millimeter, and they got to take a minute to review that. That's messed up, and I just don't think that's something that I don't think it's so important that every single call be right that you have to subject your viewers, your audience, to repeated stoppages of the action. And I think it's especially difficult in basketball where there's a lot of momentum involved. I think we saw it in the final minutes of the NCAA championship basketball game this year, a silly review that had no reason to exist and certainly no reason to go the way it did. And I think you see it in the pro games now. You're watching these finals games. They're reviewing every last thing in the last minute or two in the middle of a very exciting game. And I just think it's, as a viewer, I find it unappealing.
So if it had just been limited to those very clear fair or foul instances, for example, would you have been fine with it? Or is it like, was there a point where the proliferation came so much that it was too much for you?
Yeah. I think baseball is really what brought it home. I mean, I used to cover baseball and I still like watching it, but the stuff they review is so minute and so silly. And the process with which they do it, where the manager will stand on the top step until he gets word from his replay guy on whether he should review it or not. And and look, when replay started, the argument against it was a slippery slope argument, right? If we start doing this and it's just going to be boundary calls, it's just going to be this, it's just going to be, you know, coaches' challenges in football. The problem is once you've implemented the technology and people who are watching see that it's possible to get every call exactly right, then you have an audience that won't tolerate anything less. And now what we see it happening in the NFL, right? The NFC championship game, it ends on a blown call, or is decided by a blown call, a non-call. And so now there has to be a rule change in order to make sure we don't miss that kind of call again. And I think it stinks for the New Orleans Saints and their fans that that call did not go their way. But I think we have to step back from this sometimes and ask ourselves, what's the goal? What are we trying to accomplish? Because if we're trying to eradicate bad calls and we're trying to eradicate human officiating, then that's something that will ultimately happen. We'll go with robot officials, computerized officials, the way they do line calls in tennis, et cetera. But Bill, to me, if the ultimate goal is perfection without mistakes, without human failing, how far are we from saying, okay, well, we got the officiating taken care of. Why are we still tolerating players dropping passes? Why don't we go to robot players? Like, what are we really trying to watch out here in terms of our sports? And how important is it that every single detail of it be exactly perfect? I think part of the joy of watching sports is watching people overcome the struggle, the failings, the inevitable things that happen to human beings when they're striving for something.
What I find interesting, and to your point to some extent, I think we're having these conversations about officiating, and they're almost dominating what actually happened in the game. You think about that Saints game you brought up, which is, I think, a classic example on both sides of, yes, we don't want that call to decide that game, and it was a terrible call, an indefensibly awful call that doesn't need, or shouldn't have needed, you know, microscopic replay. That should be overturned in 10 seconds, if the rules are right to me. But what I would say is, you said, okay, well, the Saints lost that game because of that pass interference call being missed, and I've heard that argument plenty of times over the past few months, but we actually think of what happened in that game. Well, the Saints, you know, dominated in the first half, didn't really play that well, or the Rams were terrible in the first half. The Saints did not get kicked a bunch of field goals, didn't play especially well. And then after that missed field goal, Saints kicked a field goal to go up 3 points. They should have won that game and then allowed the Rams to drive. Rams kicked a game-tying field goal, if I'm not mistaken, and then won the coin toss in overtime and then threw an interception.
Won the coin toss in overtime.
Right.
Had the ball again.
Right. And so I think, yeah, but like those are all like things that have sort of been written off and pushed to the side. So it's, oh, well, we screwed up that one call. But realistically, the Saints still could have won that game and still should have won that game. On more than one occasion in the final few minutes of that game, even after the blown call.
Which is another point on why people think they want replay universally to overturn every call and get everything right, but they're wrong. They don't really want that. They want the scapegoat. If the Saints fans were forced to confront the reality that their team won the overtime coin toss and threw an interception, that their team had a 14-point lead at home in the loudest stadium I've ever been in my life, and couldn't put the Rams away in a home game to go to the Super Bowl. If they really wanted to confront that, then sure. But they don't. They would love to blame it on an official. And that's easier. It's like blame the media, right? It's like it's easier than blaming your heroes that you root and cheer for and that you live and die with. So I think sports actually needs bad calls. I don't think sports would benefit from the eradication of bad calls. The problem is we have the perspective of the coaches and players dominates the way sports are viewed right now, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's less of a buffer between coaches and players and the fans, which in some respects is good, but also in some respects, as because of the concept of media is, I think, an important one, can be bad because, you know, you can get distortions of truth. And the other thing is, the coaches and players, you know, ex-coaches, ex-players all over the media landscape with regard to sports and their coverage. So you hear coaches' opinions, players' opinions, ex-coaches' opinions, ex-players' opinions, and it's, hey, we got to get this right. There's too much at stake. We got to get this right. There's too much at stake. And that resonates with fans. Fans who are invested in their team's success say, yes, they're right. How we can't possibly allow this to happen when, in fact, if you step back and you're a fan, what you can't possibly allow to happen is to have the games be boring to watch. Like, why would you even go to a game? Like, just to see your team win or to enjoy yourself at the game? I just think we're in a dangerous place with sports where people's priorities are getting a little out of whack, and they're going along with what their favorite player, their favorite coach is saying, and they're parroting it. Yes, it's important. It's so important that the right team win. I take the position that it's not of paramount importance that the right team win. And if I'm running the NFL or if I'm running the NBA or if I'm running Major League Baseball, I'm much more concerned about keeping my customers interested and finding new ones.
All right, Dan, well, let's talk more about the replay rules and how to solve the lack of fun when it comes to late games in the NFL in a moment. But first, let's talk about our friends at ZipRecruiter, because, guys, finding a new job is a lot of work. And what if you had your own personal recruiter to help you find a better job? Now, ZipRecruiter's technology, which, of course, we've applied from the perspective of people who wanted to hire people in the past, now it can do it for you, the job searcher. Just download the ZipRecruiter job search app, let it know what kind of jobs you're interested in, and its technology starts doing the work. The ZipRecruiter app finds jobs you'll like, big plus, and puts your profile in front of employers who may be looking for someone like you. If an employer likes your profile, ZipRecruiter lets you know, so if you're interested in the job, you can apply. It's no wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated job search app. And my listeners should download the ZipRecruiter job search app today and let the power of technology work for you. So go to your app store, whether you're on an Android phone, on an iPhone, download the ZipRecruiter job search app, and don't wait. The sooner you download the free ZipRecruiter job search app, the sooner it can help you find a better job. Now back to the show. Do you think there is a portion of the fan base that's being turned off by replay?
Well, I don't know that. It's possible. I mean, we know the ratings are down all over television, period, because of the way people are consuming media now. I mean, I am. I don't watch baseball as much as I used to, and maybe it's because I'm too locked in on football now. It's my job. Maybe, but I mean, the games are tough, and you know, it's pitching changes, and it's analytics driven, and it's all this stuff, and it's just kind of like, you know, you feel like a lot of the joy is being taken out of the game. One of the things I think as sports get sort of revolutionized in the information age, I think people are forgetting the importance of infusing the new stuff with some kind of joy, right? So if you, like, we're getting off topic a little bit, but, like, if your traditional stats in baseball are no longer of the value they used to be to front offices and player evaluation, and you're putting in new stats like WAR or, you know, XFIP and all these kind of things, baseball hasn't done a sufficient job of giving their fans a reason to get excited about those stats. They've just been told, this is how front offices are viewing it, so this is how you should view it. So I think with replay, you have kind of a joyless exercise, right, where the official's staring into a monitor, or he's waiting here from upstairs, blah, 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 and there's some suspense to it. You could make it interesting. But I think if you continue to do it more and more and more and more, and it interrupts and bogs down, especially the critical final minutes of these games, I think you're causing yourself more problems than you're solving.
Did I ever tell you about my idea to solve the catch problem?
No, maybe, but I don't recall if you
That's
did.
That's also possible. You talk to a lot of people. I would not be offended if you don't remember, if I've told you already. But I'll pitch it to you here. Let me know what you think. I pitched what I call the committee, which is basically, you stick 50 former NFL wide receivers and 50 former NFL defensive backs in a room, sort of similar to like a Who Wants to Be a Millionaire style set, like it's dark, and then you show them the replay for 1 minute, all the replays you can show for 1 minute, and then they all vote. And you get to see who votes for which side. So, like, which wide receivers voted for it not to be a catch, and which cornerbacks. Then you get them to, like, the final two or three, and it's very close, and they have to vote. I think that would be fascinating television, and I think it'd probably be a better catch rule and a better way to judge catches than we actually have in the NFL.
It would be fascinating television. It'd be like C-SPAN for the NFL, right? Like, you'd have, like, the Senate voting, and they're like, who would break the tie? What if the defensive backs all voted one way and the receivers all voted another way? Now you have to have some sort of tie-breaking vote. Who's that? Is it, you know, is it the commissioner? Is it some fan?
Deion Sanders, the one player who's, you know, I guess they have to be someone who played wide receiver and cornerback. Devin Hester, maybe?
Deion.
Right? Yes, right.
Deion would be the tiebreaker, right? He played both. So, yeah, it makes sense. Now, I mean, look, because that would be interesting, right? You get to see the back and forth. But, yeah, I don't know. I still think we're better off if we accept missed calls and officiating as a game condition, much like we do with weather, right? the wind took that kick wide left. Well, you can't fix that, right? That's a game condition. Well, bad calls are a game condition as long as you're using human officials and your job is to outplay them The Saints' job was to take a deep breath, get the ball in overtime, go score a touchdown. I mean, Drew Brees, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't get it.
Do you think it's gone too far, and we sort of yes. can't put the toothpaste back? You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube at this point.
Right, and you follow on Twitter, Kevin Seifert and I go back and forth on this because he's pro replay, and I make fun of him for being sort of this sort of joyless robot about this issue. But we have fun talking about it. But yes, his point is correct, which is the fans won't accept it. Like if they did what I want them to do, there's no more replay review in sports. It's stupid and boring. It's gone. Right? We want you to watch the games, watch the players, and watch them compete against each other, and the bad breaks fall where they fall. People wouldn't accept it now because the replay TV networks would not stop showing replays, and then all the fans would be outraged, and then the coaches and the players would be outraged. Well, we have the technology to get this right. You're allowing your games to be turned on obviously wrong calls and bad decisions when you don't have to. And I don't think they'd stand for it. I think we're too far down the road, unfortunately, with that.
Do you think it's possible to push it back at least some extent? So you don't have like those, measuring whether the ball rolled out of a player's hand or a player didn't, tap the base for long enough on a turn at second base, or in football, like the catch rule where we're measuring footsteps in slow motion or fumbles or, who possessed the ball in a pile. Like, do you think fans would be okay getting rid of some of those minutia calls and having replay as like this broader structure for, things that are more obvious, like the fair or foul home run, for example?
I think that would be a step in the right direction because I don't think replay was ever supposed to be this. I don't think it was ever supposed to be slow it down frame by frame. Did the tip of the ball graze a blade of grass? We'll go back again, a real life example, the NCAA championship game. Mm-hmm. The ball is swatted out of the player's hands by the defensive player. The defensive player made that ball go out of bounds. However, they review it, and they find that after he swatted it, it stayed on the offensive player's pinky for an extra second, and so they awarded the ball to the defense because it went out off the offensive player. That's not basketball. Mm-hmm. That's not sports. That is a technicality on which a game may have turned. The ball went out of bounds as a result of an action by the defensive player. The fact that think about it. Throughout history, how many times has that play happened where you're now telling me it's been called wrong? Because, yes, it was still technically touching the offensive player's hand when the defensive player swatted it out of bounds, and we just never reviewed that one before. I think it's crazy. So, yes, I think the replay standard has to be obvious mistakes. Obvious mistakes. And I think the leagues have to do a better job of delivering the message of, yes, we're going to fix obvious mistakes, but we're not going to bog you down and bore you with endless reviews of minutia because, quite frankly, it doesn't matter, and we can't review them all. No one's going to want to watch that. So even if we got 99% of them reviewed, there would still be mistakes in that 1%. So the effort to get to perfect on this is not worth the cost.
Do you think that, in a way, fans are more angry about calls now than they were 20 or 30 years ago?
That I don't know. Because, I wasn't covering... Well, I was covering sports 20 years ago. But let's not get into that. The 1985 World Series was decided by a famously bad call by umpire Don Denkinger, right? I mean, that is, and I'm sure in St. Louis, right, they'll tell you to this day that they should have won that World Series. Right? So... That's there. Now, I think people in general seem angrier in the world than they used to be about any number of topics, if not all. Yeah, I think so. And I think that may be seeping into sports. We may just live in angry, argumentative times that are exacerbated, as has been covered in the broader media, by social media, right? So, yeah, I think so. And I think the ability for people to sort of get together in online spaces and rant together and against each other is probably not doing any of this any good because, you get to the point where your opinion is validated by the same people who are as angry as you are. So, I think there's something to that. But, people have always been passionate about sports. in Casey at the bat, there's a line where they say, "Kill him, kill the umpire," you know, because they didn't like to call balls and strikes. That was written in what, 1886. So there's always been that sort of animosity toward officiating, but I think now, you know, we live in an era, Bill, as you know, where we can all hear each other a lot more clearly, and that is for good or ill, and I think that exacerbates some of the intensity of some of these arguments.
Do you think to some extent it's our fault, you know, in the media, just from the perspective of, you know, that Saints call, for example, in 1975 that happens, but there's no Twitter for us to talk about it. There's no ESPN for us to debate it for days on end and for a fan to constantly hear that his team got screwed. I mean, is it just that, you know, the 24/7 cycle of football has made it such that you have to fill that with something and you fill it with bad calls?
Maybe that's the reason. But for whatever reason, I think there's been an increased focus in officiating as a topic to cover. And I think that's to the detriment of the sports that we watch and we cover, because I look, for instance, when Fox puts Mike Pereira in a television studio, right? Like that was hailed as a revolutionary idea. Mm-hmm. It was not, his mandate was not to examine every call that was close and tell you whether the officials got it right or not. His mandate was to interpret rules, right? The PGA Tour has been doing it for years. They have a rules official where they're like, oh, you know, he's not allowed to drop that ball there per the rules because it's closer to the hole, whatever. So Pereira was supposed to be doing something on the equivalent of that for football. But what it has morphed into, and now every network, including ours, has somebody who does this, it's become commentator on the officiating. And I think, first of all, these guys would have hated if people were doing that to them when they were officials. But you know, clearing that out of the way, I just think continuing to pick officiating as a focal topic in the coverage of sports is damaging to sports and ultimately not as important as we've made it out to be. So, yes, I do think it's our fault to some extent because I think we spend too much time talking about it. I've said this on air. We go NFL Live. You know, we make a choice, right? You can talk about officiating or you can ignore it and brush it off and treat it as a game condition, complain about it when there's a mistake. But I'm in the Rams locker room in New Orleans after the game, and they are going to the Super Bowl. And think about the number of things you could have picked to write about that day. Mm-hmm. The Saints' failure, the Rams' accomplishment, et cetera, et cetera. One of the reporters in the locker room is, this is going to have to revolutionize replay and officiating, right? It's all anybody's going to be talking about. And I thought to myself, it's kind of up to us, isn't it?
Right.
If we make the choice and the fans make the choice to focus on officiating at the level that we have, I do think that it's an unfortunate mistake that is not going to help our enjoyment of our games.
And to your point, I mean, I think about poor Mike Carey when he was doing this job for, I think it was CBS he was on. You know, he was seeing the same replays that Mike Pereira would see or someone else would see or we would see as fans or media members or people who think we know a fair amount about the game and how it's called. And quite often he would come to a different conclusion from the conclusions that other people had come up with, even other referees who were in the public space, including, for example, Mike Pereira. And I think that's telling because we talk about we can never get to that point where we are, you know, deciding on rules exactly the same way. He has access to those replays. He is a professional ref or was a professional ref for a long time and still came to alternate calls from what the rule book might say or what a different ref might say. So even if the technology is perfect, which it's not, but let's say the technology was perfect, we're still not going to be able to get to a place where the rules are going to make everyone happy or the calls are going to make everyone happy.
Agreed. Perfection in this endeavor is not attainable. The Sean Payton rebuttal to that is that doesn't mean we shouldn't strive for it. And I understand that concept when we're talking about, you know, what he does for a living, what his players do for, I get that. But in terms of this is an entertainment product. Now it's of gigantic importance to the coaches who coach it, the players who play it, you know, the people in the front offices, that's their lives. But there are many more people who have no direct investment in it. Now I don't say this to sort of belittle the concept of fandom, but as a fan of a sports team, you have an emotional investment. You do not have a direct investment. I mean, maybe you bet on the game, but your livelihood is not tied into the success of the team you root for.
All right.
There are millions more people in the world who fit that description than who fit the former description. Mm-hmm. And I think the leagues are now listening to the people in the former category because those are the people that make up their league and have a voice in their meetings, et cetera, when they need to, there needs to be at least a balance, and there needs to be someone in the room saying to the coaches and the players who are ranting about bad calls and more replay, we hear you. However, it's just as important, if not more so, that our audience not be turned off to our game. And if we're doing things that go down that path, we're all going to end up paying the price for it long term.
It sounds like it's a role for you.
But no one's listening to me, Bill. That's why it's so nice you put me on to talk about it, because they don't invite me into the meetings, at the owners' meetings, and all that. So yeah, it's I'm howling in the wind. I mean, right? I feel like an old man shouting at everybody, get off my lawn. Except I don't know. I feel like I'm arguing in favor of fun, and people aren't having it, and that just always makes me wonder what we're really trying to do here.
I don't know. I'm marching slightly away from your lawn. I'm listening. You might be converting me here.
Always welcome on the lawn. Actually, it's being mowed right now by my 15-year-old, so that's the best.
That's a genius plan.
I enjoy talking about it, but I'm increasingly frustrated that my opinion on this matter is disregarded as insane by so many people, when what I'm arguing for is let's enjoy watching sports more than, you know, we are at this point.
All right. Well, if people want to enjoy more of your thoughts and your insight, where can they do that?
Oh, well, let's see. We did something today being Monday, on checking in with the 5 first-round quarterbacks from last year, because I was at Jets last week, and I had the idea to check in with them. So I made some calls from people in Buffalo and Baltimore and with the Jets, talked to me about where those quarterbacks stand. Mm-hmm. So that's on ESPN.com now. And then later in the week, we'll have something coming out of mini camps. That'll be on .com. And I'll be on NFL Live on Thursday, and I'll be hosting it on Friday. So,
oh, wow.
That'll be fun. And I'll be around. Considering it's the off season, I haven't disappeared completely.
I feel like that's a pointed shot at me.
I'm going to Australia.
Yeah, I was going to say. Hey, you know, not all of us have NFL Live hosting duties to worry about.
They throw me one every now and then. I like it. Nice.
All right. Well, Mr. Graziano, always a pleasure. Please get back to destroying the replay industrial complex, and we'll get back to you later during the offseason.
Thank you for letting me vent.
All right. Thanks so much to Dan Graziano. And we're going to have Ben Lindbergh coming on the show to talk about his book, The MVP Machine, after the break on The Bill Barnwell Show. All right. Back here on The Bill Barnwell Show. I'm still Bill Barnwell, but I have a new guest right now. We've had a couple of former Grantland people over the past few weeks come on and talk about their books, both of which have been excellent. I am excited to have another former Grantland contributor who now contributes for The Ringer talking about his book that he wrote with Travis Sawchuk, The MVP Machine, How Baseball's New Nonconformists Are Using Data to Build Better Players. It is my friend Ben Lindbergh. Ben, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. The Grantland connection has led to a lot of podcast guests for both of us because we keep writing books.
Well, one of us is writing books. This is your second book, and it's excellent. I am biased, to be fair, but I remember reading Moneyball in college, and I read it like on my dorm room bed in maybe 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours, but then like did not get up to go to the bathroom, did not do anything else, did not check my phone, did not check my computer, like sat there absolutely desperately interested and read it start to finish. And don't have that experience with books very frequently. And I had the same experience reading your book yesterday, which was a rare thing for me and really fascinating to me, because I'm at least vaguely aware of what's happening in baseball, but there was so much insight and so much detail into what is happening in Major League Baseball behind closed doors and sort of in the public sphere today that, you know, I've seen hints of that in articles, but haven't seen necessarily written about at this length and with this level of detail. So in terms of baseball books in the past, I think there's a lot of books that have come out since Moneyball that have sort of either been positioned or their authors have tried to present it as such, but basically as Moneyball 2.0. And I think this is the first book that really reminds me of that. Really, it seems like it's a significant progression on what's happened over the past 15 years. And You get this. You know, you sort of write about Moneyball early in the book as sort of a, you know, not a preface, but sort of a, as a positioning point. And if Moneyball was about, you know, player acquisition, what is the MVP machine about?
Well, that is the case that we were trying to make, and I think you're right. There's been a whole lineage of Moneyball-inspired books and books in that Moneyball mold, and I wrote one, and my co-author Travis Sochik wrote one, Big Data Baseball, about the Pirates, and a lot of those books are this team, this executive is doing this brilliant thing to find this undervalued talent. And that really has been the story of baseball for the past 15 years or so. It's how do we go acquire pre-existing talent that's out there, but for whatever reason, the market doesn't recognize it and it's undervalued. And so now I think we've gotten to the point where there's something close to parity among front offices because they're all looking at the game in that way. And you can't go out and get the guy who has the high on-base percentage and no one knows it because everyone knows it. So now I think the advantage has shifted where it's not so much about going out and finding talent that's out there. It's about creating talent or enhancing talent. And Moneyball didn't have a lot to say on that subject because I don't think teams were really doing anything different in that area at the time than they'd done for about the century before that. Whereas now, I think teams are really making strides, and players and coaches and independent instructors, in making players better. And so the questions that Moneyball didn't really attempt to answer, which is, you know, how did Scott Hatteberg get good at walking? Or how did some other guy that Billy Beane acquired because he had some desirable trait, where did that desirable trait come from? And that's what our book is about. Can you create those guys? Can you make your guys a bit better? Because in Moneyball, Billy Beane explicitly says, you know, the guys who I go out and trade for, they're good, they see pitches, they take walks, but I can't teach my own players to do that. And in order to do that, I'd have to get them in diapers, is something he says in the book. Whereas now I think it's much more possible to teach that kind of trade and really every sort of skill. It seems like talent is more malleable than was previously believed.
And certainly, I mean, this is a book where, you know, this process is certainly going on, but it's been going on for several years now. I mean, was there a point you could go back to and say, okay, this year or this season or generally in this time frame, did teams sort of get to that point where there was parity and then the shift sort of started happening to development and getting more out of the players they currently have?
Yeah, I mean, it's still an ongoing process. I think as we were working on the book, even we could see it happening because we would talk to some of these coaches, you know, in the college ranks or in independent facilities at the beginning of the book, and we'd say, oh, wow, this guy seems like he has a bright future. Maybe someday he'll work for a baseball team. And then by the time we finished the book, half of them were already. And it was, you know, how do we keep track of, okay, this guy went to work for the Twins and this guy went to work for the Phillies. So it's still happening, but I think it's really within the past 5 years or so. And I think there have been a few notable examples of players who kind of proved the point that you could turn your career around using some sort of information. And for me, it was Rich Hill with the Red Sox in late 2015, who at that point was a 35-year-old pitcher who'd been bouncing around the big leagues and the minors and indie ball for years. And he got a recommendation from Brian Bannister, who was a Red Sox executive and coach, and he recognized something based on the data that hadn't been available before about Hill's curveball, and he told him, hey, you should throw this pitch more. Don't worry about establishing the fastball, the old baseball advice. Throw the pitch that works best for you. And Hill became one of the best pitchers in baseball kind of out of nowhere and landed a big contract. And we've seen similar transformations with guys in the middle of their careers, like J.D. Martinez, like Justin Turner. There are a few guys who I think have brought a lot of attention to this, but really until the last couple of years, I don't know that most teams were making this a priority, although you did have your early adopters like the Houston Astros, who, in addition to doing other things well, have really been at the forefront of development. And so all these things that started kind of outside the game or were player-driven or showed up at these hotbeds of baseball instruction outside the game, now those are getting adopted into the game and by teams. But that's really only within the last couple of years.
Yeah, what I find really interesting is that you mentioned Brian Bannister, and he is an ex-player. His father was a player, I believe, you know, someone who was with the Royals, was someone who was quant-friendly to some extent during his career, and then now works for the Red Sox in an analytics role. You also mentioned that there are spaces where, you know, significant development is happening outside of the sort of traditional, you know, major league, minor league baseball spectrum. And almost universally, at least in the book, they are described as happening in very strange places. Dry flying, which is the first pitching and now also hitting as well. I guess think tank maybe might be a way to put it. You know, the development process there is happening, according to the book, at some point in a Tacoma warehouse where there used to be MMA fights. You went to go see someone in a Northridge office park, Adam Ottavino, the Yankees pitcher who went to Northeastern, who I'm slightly biased towards as a fellow Northeastern graduate, rented a vacant storefront in New York City. I mean, these development processes are happening outside of the game in such sort of strange, unlikely places, perhaps. And even you mentioned drive lines, yeah. Basically like a jerry rig sort of, you know, it's not like a refined developed place or wasn't, or, you know, certainly several years ago. I mean, do you think that sort of is encouraging to players? Like, you know, if you're a player who wants to drastically change what he's doing, like he almost gets more out of it by being in a place that is so obviously non-traditional that it sort of gets them out of their element, or do you think that's going to be refined over the years to come?
Yeah, I mean, we had to come up with a lot of synonyms for garage or warehouse or office park in the book because it does seem like all these places are situated in those areas. And I think it's in part because there wasn't a whole lot of funding. These weren't really established places. Mm-hmm. This thinking kind of developed in these areas that were far from the bright lights of the big leagues. And I think there's a reason for that. In the past, you had to have played baseball to coach baseball players for a major league organization. That was kind of the primary qualification, was where did you play and how did you play? And that, I think, led to a stagnation in thinking because you would just have these teachings passed down from generation to generation. This is what I learned as a player, and this is what I will teach players. And so I think all of this new thinking had to spring up in these unlikely locations. And it's kind of a parallel, or it mirrors the sabermetric movement of 20 years or so ago, because you had these outsiders. You know, the classic Bill James was a night watchman in a factory, and he was thinking these things about baseball. And gradually, it took a while, but those ideas were adopted into the game so that you had all these sabermetric outsiders become insiders. Mm-hmm. And now I think the same thing is happening with coaching and with instruction, which traditionally was the province of, you know, high-level successful athletes and still is to a certain extent, but now I think non-traditional backgrounds are having a say. And so there are a lot of these facilities where it's kind of no frills and it's just all business, and it's let's re-examine what has been taught, let's see if these teachings actually hold up. And, you know, they have high-tech devices in these sort of unassuming locations, but I do think that teams now are making an effort to import all of that so that it happens in-house, so that they don't have to outsource this development to these facilities. So just as we were working on the book, I think 8 or 9 employees from Driveline Baseball, the facility you're talking about, were hired by major league teams in some capacity this past offseason, and a lot of teams are kind of building their own Driveline-style programs, sometimes with help from Driveline, so that the idea is that they don't have to kind of hand off their players to someone else or just say goodbye in September, October, and say hello again in February or March and not know what happened in between, which is kind of what has happened in the past in baseball. Players would just disappear over the offseason, and that's, I think, the time when they can make the most meaningful improvements. So teams are, and players are, making the most of that time.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book that the most frequent time when pitchers, for example, have Tommy John surgery tends to be in the months where they're coming back from that winter off.
Right.
So it's like possibly helping the risk of injury as well. I mean, do you think that's inevitable, where there's, you know, these sort of outside sources, your drive lines, for example, are going to be integrated and implemented into the traditional development model when it comes to being in a major league ballpark or working with people who are working for a team? Or do you think it could be something where eventually there is conflict, where you have a player who, not Trevor Bauer, but someone, you know, perhaps Trevor Bauer Jr. or someone like that, who is more comfortable working outside of an organization with an independent thinker, with someone who, you know, like Driveline 2.0, as opposed to working with the people within the organization? Is that conflict happening already, or is it just sort of teams are realizing that they need to get on board with these things that are happening elsewhere?
Yeah, there has been conflict at times in, say, old school organizations that don't embrace the same thinking, where someone will go to one of these facilities and they'll change their swing, or they'll learn something about how their pitches work or how they should do drills, and then they'll come back to their organization and they'll say, we don't do that here and you shouldn't do that here. And then there is kind of a conflict. I think that is getting more rare just because these ideas are getting more established and they've been proven to work in a lot of cases. There are a lot of success stories out there. So I think that's happening less, but I think there will still be players who prefer to work with a third party just because you may not necessarily want your employer knowing everything about you and having all of this data on you if you can go somewhere else and keep that to yourself and still get the same quality instruction. So I think that's the question. Will so many of these people be hired by teams that maybe the option to go outside won't even be there anymore? Mm-hmm. But I think as long as it is, there will still be a desire to do that. And I think a lot of players may just invest in personal coaches and personal technology. You know, there's a lot of technology that has kind of driven this movement because so many things about player performance can be quantified now. And once they can be quantified, they can be improved. But players, for the most part, still to access these devices have to go to teams, have to go to facilities. But we may see baseball players follow more of the golf model, where golf pros will have their own personal coaches, they'll have their own TrackMan devices to track, you know, their hits and their mechanics. And I think economically speaking, it makes sense for successful baseball players to do that too. So that may be where we're headed.
Yeah, could it be something where even on an agency side, where, you know, if you're Scott Boras and you say, okay, we have, you know, the best tools for improving yourself when it comes to, you know, the best cameras or the best, you know, the best sort of version of Driveline that's out there. Do you think that's something that might lure players to different agencies in years to come?
Yeah, definitely. And that's happening a little bit already. I mean, traditionally, agents haven't done a whole lot to enhance their players' performance on the field. You know, maybe they've taken care of aspects of their life off the field, but I think they've just tried to market their players based on their previous performance instead of trying to enhance that performance. That's kind of been left to the player and to the team. But that may be changing. I mean, for one thing, you have kind of an information disadvantage where at this point it's pretty much impossible for an agent to sell a team on a player because the team knows more about the player and his performance than the agent does. So you're not going to talk a baseball operations department now into signing someone because they know exactly how they're valuing him. So I think an agent may be able to make a difference now by doing some of this enhancement. And we do write a bit about it, the book in one example, the Bledsoe agency, where a former pitcher who went to Driveline and was into all of these ideas, Caleb Cotham, he became an agent and he sort of set up a mini Driveline inside this agency and was helping guys get better. And then, of course, he was hired this past offseason by the Cincinnati Reds to be a pitching coach. And they've perhaps not coincidentally have quite a pitching turnaround this year. But that's kind of the danger. You know, he was setting up this sort of system and then a team said, hey, we want that. And he was attracted to the idea because he had previously pitched for the Reds, and at the time they were kind of old school and didn't have all of this information, and he found that frustrating. So he found it appealing to go and bring this information to that team. So I think that's always the problem. You know, it's always tempting to work for a team and make a difference, so there's always the risk that these people outside the game will be tempted to go inside.
It seems inevitable. I mean, it's just, you know, I think there may be certain people who might end up just being so fiercely independent that they're going to stay outside. But it seems like the majority of people, even thinking back to the people who were, you know, sabermetricians and, you know, in the first decade of the 21st century, the vast majority of the people who were doing that, with maybe yourself excluded and a few other people, did go work for teams. I mean, look at Fangraphs or BP 10 years ago. Yeah. The majority of those people are working for teams at this point. So it seems like it's, in one way or another, inevitable. In terms of...
As the former editor of Baseball Perspective, I had to replace many people who were poached by teams, which was always a chore, but nice for them, but tough for me. So yes, I do think that will happen. You know, you'll have some people who have sort of an independent streak, or they've set up something so profitable that the incentives just aren't there for them to go inside, or, you know, maybe they're abrasive in some way or unpredictable so that teams are wary of employing them. So there will be some exceptions, I think. And also, I think some people feel pretty strongly about being in the public and being able to share their research and share their ideas and help the most players possible, as opposed to the players for one organization. So I think that's why some people talk to us for this book who you'd think on the surface might not even have that much incentive to do that. Someone like Brian Bannister, who is employed by the Red Sox and has incentive to protect information, but was someone who talked to us a lot for the book and was very helpful, because I think having been a player himself who kind of bumped up against, you know, the orthodoxy of baseball and people who were doubting him because he was trying to use data when no one else was doing that, I think he feels an obligation to kind of pay it forward and help other players. And I think that becomes even more of an ethical imperative, possibly, as teams make strides in injury prevention, because obviously, if you can prevent injuries, if you can bring guys back from injuries more quickly, that's a huge competitive advantage. And some teams are making some gains in that area. But do you feel okay about keeping that information to yourself and knowing that other guys out there are hurting themselves and their careers are ending because you're kind of hoarding this information yourself? So I think a lot of people will feel some conflict over that, too.
Do you think that should lead Major League Baseball as an entity to start doing more research in this space?
Yeah, I do think so. And they have done some, you know, they've done some research in Tommy John surgery and elbow injuries, and at least tried to get a good record of all of the injuries and the recovery time so that there's sort of a baseline to work with. So I do think they've made some efforts in that area, but the teams have probably been more aggressive about that. So I think for the good of the sport and for amateur players and for the next generation, it probably would behoove Major League Baseball to be a leader in that area.
All right, let's get back to Ben and the MVP machine in a moment. But first, guys, they say a great offense starts with a great defense. And that's especially true when it comes to the fuel you put in your car. Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline is engineered with four levels of defense against gunk, wear, corrosion, and friction to help keep your engine running like new. And now, you and your car have even more reasons to celebrate with the Shell Great Gas Giveaway. It's your chance to win free fuel for a year or one of thousands of prizes with a total prize value of over $1 million. If you're a Fuel Rewards member, you'll automatically receive one entry every time you fill up with 8 gallons or more. And if you choose new Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline, you'll get 4 entries. Not a member? Download the Fuel Rewards app now or go to fuelrewards.com/win to join. In engines that continuously use Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline, no purchase is necessary. Promotion ends September 1st, 2019. See official rules at fuelrewards.com/win for how to enter by mail and all details. Now back to the show. So the central character of the book, someone who I'm surprised spoke as much as he did, maybe, but maybe that's just me being naive, is, I think it's fair to say, Trevor Bauer, the pitcher for the Indians, who, I mean, you detail his development from growing up as a, you know, as a small child, and then all the way to his professional career and to his most recent seasons with the Indians. It's fair to say Bauer is unique. I think some people, certainly if you're a baseball fan, you're well aware of his personality on Twitter. He can be prickly. Yeah. I think it's fair to say. He is very iconoclastic. He is very sort of, I think unique is maybe the fairest way to put it. But of course, very successful, very good at what he does. And as you point out throughout the book, someone who does not have the body of a Major League Baseball player in many ways. He's several standard deviations below your typical baseball player in terms of his athleticism, but someone who has worked incredibly hard to cast himself as a Major League Baseball pitcher. At the same time, he is someone who developed under very unique circumstances. His father had no interest in baseball, but had applied a sort of scientific method to getting better at pitching. He ended up, you know, randomly being recommended to a long toss practitioner as an adolescent. And then now, of course, practices long toss regularly, in his warmups for games today and to keep his arm strong. Do you think Bauer is just so unique and so sort of, a product of his environment that it's impossible to imagine 10 or 50 or 100 more Trevor Bowers in Major League Baseball 20 years from now? Or do you think that's going to be more like the sort of norm when it comes to players who are thinking for themselves and players who are developing at their own path and in their own way?
Yeah, well, he, I think, is worried that it will be the latter, that for his own sake, that other pitchers will come along and other players will do the same thing he's done, and maybe that they will have more natural talent and athleticism than he does, and so if they apply his methods, then they will surpass him, which, you know, I think we're seeing now some stars, guys who are already really good, adopt these ideas and go from good to great. So it's not just guys who are kind of on the fringes of the game resurrecting their careers. It's guys who are already excelling who just want to be even better than that. So I think that is something that will happen. You know, he is wired a little differently from most players and from most people, for better and for worse. He is an imperfect poster boy for this movement in that he does make, you know, inflammatory and offensive comments, and he is kind of abrasive with teammates and has, you know, for various reasons kind of caused friction wherever he's gone. So there's the question of whether that has hampered or helped his efforts to kind of move player development forward. You know, on the one hand, he goes around annoying people a lot, and so there's even more resistance that maybe isn't necessary. On the other hand, he is very immune to criticism and seems to persist in his practices no matter how many detractors there are, which perhaps has helped him push things forward where other people would have been kind of cowed by the establishment. So I think it's sort of hard to tell. He is a unique character, and not always in great ways, but I think that what he has introduced into the game now kind of goes beyond him and has really filtered down to amateurs and to other organizations, where he was kind of the first major league pitcher to use this new piece of tech called an edrotronic camera, which is sort of the technological star of the book, in that it's this high-definition, high-speed, affordable camera, or at least affordable by a big league baseball player. And, you know, he used that and paired it with other devices that could measure the spin of his pitches, and was able to design pitches and refine pitches in really a scientific sort of way, as opposed to the past, where you go by feel and it's trial and error and someone tells you to try this grip or that grip and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. He sort of set out to design pitches that he decided, I want it to move this way, I want it to behave that way, and using this combination of camera and other measurement devices, he was able to see exactly how it came out of his hand and adjust it subtly to get it closer to the movement profile he wanted. And I think that process has really extended beyond Bauer, so that many teams are now doing this, many pitchers are now doing this, and so he sort of broke the mold and introduced this technology and this process of pitch design into baseball, and it has spread well beyond him, which has helped a lot of pitchers and has also indirectly hurt a lot of hitters who are having a harder time hitting pitching now. And so I think that's really dramatically reshaped player development and is sort of changing what the sport looks like on a league-wide level, because this current run environment we're seeing, where strikeouts are kind of out of control and breaking balls are moving more than ever before and being thrown more than ever before and fastballs are faster, it's almost as if players are getting so good that they're potentially breaking baseball here. And MLB may actually have to intervene if it wants the game to look a little more like it did before.
You mentioned in the book, you guys actually update a study that I found really fascinating, talking about how players are improving, you know, sort of on the whole over the past few years, even though there had been a period previously where studies had found that they were stagnating in terms of their overall talent level. Can you explain how that process works?
Yeah, that was really interesting. It's hard to assess the league's talent level over time, and people often wrestle with this question, you know, how good would Babe Ruth be today? And that's hard to determine statistically, because, of course, players are always competing against their peers, but there are ways you can kind of indirectly get to an answer, you know, by looking at, say, a certain group of players in each year who are within an age range where you would expect their own performance to be stable. And so if their performance as a group declines or improves, then that can tell you something about the league's talent level as a whole. So using that method, you're able to get a sense of to go. Mm-hmm. And as you would expect, if you look at the long-term trend line, it's just up, up, up. Players are constantly getting better. But there was kind of a lull and a plateau, you know, about 15 years ago or a little less than that, where it seemed like the improvement, according to that method that had been continuing for decades, had just leveled off. And I think, you know, some researchers who noticed that speculated that maybe we were kind of coming up against the natural limits. Maybe there wasn't that much more improvement that could be made. And yet, in the last decade or so, not only has that reversed itself and the climb has continued, but it's actually been one of the steepest and most rapid climbs of any point in baseball history. So just when it looked like baseball players were maybe about as good as they could ever be, they've now started improving at one of the fastest paces ever. And I think there could be multiple reasons for that. You know, partly it's maybe the after effects of the Moneyball movement and just selecting better players. But I think it also has been and will continue to be this player development process, because it really is possible for players to unlock latent talent that in earlier eras just would have gone untapped, unrecognized. And so I think that's being reflected now. We're seeing it with late career guys who are kind of rehabilitating themselves, but we're also seeing it with this youth movement that's sweeping the sport right now, where, you know, the production from under 25 year olds is kind of at historic levels. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
Mm-hmm. Would you endorse the Edgertronic camera to one day be a possible Hall of Fame candidate?
I don't know if that would make for a very interesting exhibit. Well, maybe it would. If you could film yourself, it could be an interactive display. But I think there is an element of that, right, where a lot of this stuff would not have happened without this technology that's kind of come along lately. I think even if the willingness were there, and maybe it was once you had all of these, you know, non-traditional people in front offices, I don't think you could have quantified and diagnosed what was going on with players. And in the book, I try out a lot of this stuff myself. And, you know, with me, of course, it just reveals how much worse I am than actual professional players. But with them, it can diagnose things that in the past you just couldn't see. You know, even if you were filming yourself with some other kind of camera, just trying to eyeball it, you couldn't detect exactly how all of your body parts were moving and the force that was being applied at every stage of your swing or your delivery. And so I think that that piece of tech, you know, as much as just about anything, and you'd have to put pitch and batted ball tracking technology up there too, but all that stuff, all of the introduction and influx of that technology, I think is as responsible for all of the stuff we're seeing as, you know, the personnel changes too. So sure, cameras in the Hall of Fame. I like it.
So you mentioned, you know, that one could perhaps film themselves and get some measure of their own improvement. And you went, like you said, and did all this. You went to several places. You had yourself filmed the same way that they would film a minor, independent, or Major League Baseball player who was hoping to improve. I don't want to spoil it too much because it's really entertaining. It's really my favorite part of the book in a lot of ways. But is there one takeaway or one thing you heard that you sort of think about now after the fact more than anything else from what you heard from those multiple camps?
It was pretty eye-opening. I mean, you know, not in terms of exposing that I'm not going to be a big leaguer, because that did not come as a surprise, but just seeing the depth and the detail and the granularity. I mean, I went to Driveline and I did the motion capture. I had 47 markers stuck all over my body and was throwing off a mound, and, you know, they kind of turned me into a video game and were able to analyze the forces. And then I went to other places, and I think the most enlightening part of it was the hitting stuff that I experimented with, because that has kind of been lagging behind. You know, pitching and defense, I think, have benefited the most from the introduction of analytics, just because pitching, you know, you kind of have the ball in your hand, you can do what you want to do. Hitting is this reactive activity, and it's a little harder to study what your opponent is doing and adjust to it. But now you have all of these devices. So I tried something called a K-vest that, you know, it's four sensors. So you strap something on your hand, your arm, your chest, your pelvis, and then you take some swings, and it just tracks exactly how your body is moving and rotating. So it just kind of graphs each of those sensors' movements over time, so that you can see the sequence in which your body is moving. You can see the power, you can see the speed. And it exposes why you're not good, essentially, or why you're not as good as you could be in a way that would have been really difficult to diagnose before. And so if you can see that, okay, my sequencing is off here, my timing is off, I can adjust that. You know, it comes with drills that you can, in a very focused way, work on that specific skill. Or if it exposes just some physical inadequacy where you can't move in the way that you should want to move, you can then get in the gym and work on that specific body part and do drills that are designed to strengthen that part of you. So there's almost nothing, I think, you know, I've learned throughout this process that can't be made somewhat better, at least, even if you're already at the big league level, if you haven't tried any of this before. I think it's sort of an inspirational message. That was one of the things that made me want to work on this book, is that it was kind of intoxicating, this idea that guys who'd been in the big leagues for years could have untapped, unsuspected reservoirs of talent. I always assumed that to get to the big leagues and to stay there, you had to have just maxed out your natural ability, because it's so competitive. You're fighting off thousands of other guys who want that job. And yet it turns out that you can get to that pinnacle of your profession and still have a higher gear to get to, which to me is kind of a nice idea, because I think it applies to a lot of us. Even if we don't want to be big leaguers, we want to be better at something. And some of these principles and, you know, ideas of practice that players have adopted, I think, are transferable to other areas of life.
For sure. Well, one thing I do, if you want to get better, I don't know what you want to get better at, if you want to read about a really entertaining development process in baseball, recommend reading The MVP Machine. Ben, do you have a preferred place where people can go out and buy your new book with Travis Sacher?
I do not. Wherever is most convenient for them, just go get it, whatever store, whatever format, I am fine with that. And I guess go to the bathroom first in case you're like Bill and you can't get up until it's over.
And in case you people want to check out more of the work you do outside of the book, where can people find more of what you do?
All my writing is at The Ringer. I also do a podcast about baseball at Fangraphs called Effectively Wild. So you can find me at those places or on Twitter at my name, Ben Lindbergh.
Awesome. Well, Ben, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bill.
All right. Thanks so much to my guest today, ESPN's Dan Graziano and The Ringer's Ben Lindbergh. Again, check out Ben's book, The MVP Machine with Travis Sacher. Really enjoyed it. Highly recommend it. I'm honestly biased, but would definitely recommend you give it a shot. It's a really easy, fun, and enlightening read. We're back. I know we took a few weeks off. We are back on a weekly schedule for the foreseeable future. We'll be back, I think, later next week. More football stuff to come. A lot of discussion to get to. You know, quiet time of the year. I think we may look at some more historical stuff. Maybe get out of the sort of traditional, week-to-week analysis with not much happening. But season previews around the corner. July, we're back in the grind when it comes to previewing the NFL season. So thanks so much for listening, and more football on the way.